direct from the web, it's Billy Masters Live. And now, please welcome your host, Billy Masters.
Oh my God, we're here. Another show. Hey everybody, welcome to Billy Masters Live. I am, of course, your host, Billy Masters. And today, thank you, Monica, is Thursday, April 15th, 2021. Oh my God, what a show we have today. But before I get to that, you know, last week, right after the show, I had to zip on a plane, go down to Florida to take care of some business at the beach house. And was planning on doing today's show from Florida. And then through a number of very frantic situations, I'm back in Boston. I'm back with the parents. And even more amazingly, right after this show, I have to go get my second Pfizer shot, which is interesting because our first guest, Richard Meinards, we have been trying to do this show for months, it seems. And he had conflicts, then he was getting his shot, and then I had other people. So it's just been crazy. So here's the thing. Get your shot. Get your shot, because as I've often said, a little prick is better than no prick at all. There you go. And then, of course, later in the show, speaking of, well, not little, God knows, former West Hollywood Mayor John Duran is going to be on, and we're going to talk about how West Hollywood is doing 1 year into the pandemic. And I have a lot of things that I haven't talked about. I haven't talked about Meghan and Harry. I haven't talked about Sharon Osbourne and Piers Morgan. I haven't talked about the death of Prince Philip. And we planned this interview with Richard Meinards, and all these things came up, so I've been waiting. So I am desperate to talk to you about these things, and I'm not going to waste any more time. I'm going to get to it. Okay, as you all know, you know, my whole life, I was a fan of Joan Rivers. I became friends with her in high school. I used to write her jokes. She would send me great, funny little letters. When she had her daytime show, I went and was an intern there with her, sort of a PA, unpaid. It was very clear to me it was going to be unpaid. But at the top of the Joan Rivers show, she would, and sometimes at the bottom, I have to admit, she would have different gossip columnists. And these were my favorite parts of the show. And we've had many of the people here. Steve Kometko was there. Michael Kastner was there. But this is where I discovered Richard Meinards. Now, having been a longstanding Anglophile, I loved everything royal, which, of course, is part of what being an Anglophile is. And Richard always gave us a glimpse into the life of the royals. He had the best dish. He had scoops. And with everything going on in the world now, there's only one person I would trust. And that is my first guest, esteemed writer, former royal correspondent for the Daily Mail and a million other places. He is now in Montecito, like basically in Prince Harry's backyard, writing for the paper in Montecito. And he is here now with us, our royal correspondent, Richard Meinards.
How nice to see you, Billy, after so very long. I do remember Joan Rivers' days at CBS in New York very, very fondly. And of course, as you say, the gossip show, we used to do it just every Monday, but because it was so popular and the ratings were so high, they started doing it every day. And Tribune Entertainment, which is the production company, signed me to a contract. And I did it, as you know, for 3 or 4 years. And that made me into a, quote, celebrity, where people would come up to me and ask my autograph, which I found extraordinarily enchanting, really. So it's
and didn't you
and then? I went on to do Geraldo Rivera.
That's what I was going to say, yeah.
You on?
Yeah, I
then
remember
went on to
that.
Geraldo Rivera, which is another two. Yeah, and he did an hour-long show every Friday called Celebrity News. And I was on with the New York Post, Cindy Adams, and the late Mike Walker, who was the gossip columnist for the National Enquirer. And then I started doing other stuff, and I was an anchor with Day and Date on CBS, Royals commentator on ABC World News Now. It was quite an extraordinary trajectory, and I could put that all down to being on Joan Rivers all the time. And I can't thank her enough for helping me out and getting me started.
Well, it's funny. I mentioned I'm an Anglophile. Certainly, there was no more Anglophile than Joan Rivers. She loved the Brits and she really loved the Royals. But I'm curious, how did you actually get started?
Well, I've always had a fascination with the royal family. And I remember when I was at Cambridge on the evening news as a chief reporter in the district, I started covering the horse trials in England, which are very royal oriented because the Queen loves horses, as does her daughter, Princess Anne. So I go to the Badminton horse trials at a very grand estate in the southwest of England in May. And in September, I go to the Burley horse trials in Lincolnshire and I see the royal family. And because of that sort of contact, when I started with the Daily Mirror, they made me their royal reporter. And of course, I was down at Windsor every weekend, meeting Charles at the Guards Polo Club. And then, of course, I moved to the Daily Mail during 77, which was the Queen's Silver Jubilee year, 25 years on the British throne. And of course, I was, for better or worse, with her pretty much every day, with her and Prince Philip. And it was an extraordinary occasion. And I remember it most fondly, particularly my meetings with Philip. He didn't suffer fools gladly. He could be very abrasive. He could even be arrogant and rude. But I found him extraordinarily witty and funny. And if he liked you, then you were fine. If he didn't like you, he'd let you know about it.
Did you get to see Philip and Elizabeth interact? What did you think of the marriage itself?
Well, I thought it was a very staunch marriage. I mean, obviously, they've been married for 73 years, which is extraordinary. And, you know, we knew this was going to happen with Philip because he was, you know, 2 months from his 100th birthday. He just had his longest stay in hospital ever, 28 days, where he had major heart surgery. We hoped that he might get to his 100th birthday, but it was not to be. But it was a true love match. They met when she was just 13 as Princess Elizabeth, the daughter of King George VI, and he was a naval cadet at Dartmouth, which is the British version of Annapolis. And they met, and it was quite an extraordinary occasion because they came in on the Royal Yacht Britannia, which was decommissioned in 1997. And as they were leaving Dartmouth, and the princess was waving at Philip, he was in a rowboat behind, rowing madly. And he wouldn't stop. And the king was just saying, silly bugger, you know, go away. Stop being such a pest. But Philip was persistent. And that persistence paid off because, you know, they thought they'd give it some time and that Elizabeth will get off this kick. But she never did. And it was a true love match. He was this dashing young man who was a prince of Greece. He didn't really have much. He came to the royal family with about £5 and a secondhand suit. But it was an extraordinary love match that obviously stood the test of time. And it's so sad that we have this situation now in the time of the pandemic. Are you able to see me?
Yes, I can. Yep.
Yes, you can see me. In the time of the pandemic, it's so sort of casual and very low key because obviously Philip was a much decorated former Royal Naval man. He gave up his life in the Royal Navy to become the husband of the Queen. And he got a number of decorations during his lifetime. But because of the pandemic, this funeral at St. George's Chapel at Windsor on Saturday, it has a capacity of 800 people. But there are only going to be 30 people there because under the government regulations, because of the pandemic, they will not allow any more people. And so it's going to be a lot of ceremonial outside. But inside, it's going to be sort of cavernous and rather quiet.
You know, what do you make of the criticism that we've seen coming from the Brits that some people are upset about the wall-to-wall coverage and it's preempted MasterChef and all of that? And the BBC is like, you know, too bad. It's the sovereign's consort and that's how it goes.
Well, you know, I'm sorry for MasterChef, but how often does the Duke of Edinburgh die? He's been part of our lives for 73 years, and he was a staunch supporter of the Queen. He was always with her. He didn't like it at the beginning, as he said one time, "What am I, a bloody amoeba, having to walk behind her, one step, two steps behind her?" But in time, he became the jewel in the crown. He really was her rock and the power behind the throne, particularly when it came to domestic matters with the children. But when it came to state matters, obviously the Queen being the monarch, who had to assign all the, you know, laws of assent for legal reasons or whatever, she was certainly the Queen. But he was her strongest supporter, without question.
You know, I think it's interesting that people may not know, unless, of course, they saw The Crown, is that Philip also engineered the televising of Elizabeth's coronation. And so it's so interesting that now we're going to see this.
Well, he was very conscious of the royal family and how it was perceived by the British public. And the coronation in 1953... they didn't want to televise it because they thought that people would be gathering pubs in wrong places and this was a sacred ceremonial event and should not be publicized. But in the end, Peter Dimmock from the BBC, who ran that kind of unit at the time, kept on and on and on, and his tenaciousness worked out with Prince Philip's help. He obviously felt that it should be publicized and on television. And of course, television at that time was very much in its infancy in 1953 and was in black and white, God forbid. But it worked out and it was a huge success and led to the coverage of the royal family that we've had since then in the last half century. And of course, anything with the royal family is a ratings bonanza, for better or worse. And I'm sure that the funeral on Saturday at Windsor, which is being covered by a number of networks here in America, will be very, very well watched. It will have a lot of ceremonial and traditional British stuff, but it will be outside St. George's Chapel in Windsor Castle, whereas in the chapel itself, which dates back to the 14th century, in King Edward III. And that's going to be very, very quiet, because as I say, it has a capacity of 800 people. And all you're going to have in there is 30 people, the Queen herself, obviously, Prince Charles and Camilla, and other relatives, as well as three relatives of Prince Philip himself from Germany, who are currently being quarantined in readiness for the service at St. George's Chapel on Saturday. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I had also read, didn't I read that the Prime Minister gave up his seat so that family members would be able to have that seat?
Yes, without question, because obviously the minimal capacity with Boris Johnson was one seat, although obviously as Prime Minister, he would normally have attended. But because we live in really dire times, it was decided that he would give up his seat so that other members of the royal family or the close-knit members of the royal family to the Queen would be able to attend.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to watch. Obviously, there's lots going on in the royal family right now. But I want to go back. I found a clip because, of course, I have every episode that Joan Rivers ever did. So I found a clip of you back in the day. And what I think is really interesting, I don't think you've seen this one in over 20 years. And you kind of infer that something's happening, and let's see how right you were. So here's a clip from the Joan Rivers Show.
Now, what about Princess Diana and Prince Charles?
Well, unfortunately, as a dodo. Prince Charles has agreed to disagree. He spends a lot of time up in Balmoral in the north of Scotland, shooting or just being miserable. Diana does her own thing in London. I know for a fact that she indeed now does have a new boyfriend, so she can do whatever she wishes.
Wait, go back. Okay. She has a new boyfriend?
Yes, indeed so. Someone about her age, I believe a military type of person, who's been popping in and out of Highgrove, their country house in Gloucestershire, and has been seen poking around the royal bedroom, and I'm sure it's not actually watering the flowers.
Now, let me ask you, what would happen if she became pregnant?
Well, this would be a major problem, because we'd all know it wasn't Prince Charles, because he's never there to do anything. He has been spending time in Scotland with these two older friends of his, Lady Camilla Parker Bowles and Lady Kanga Tryon. She's known as Kanga not because she bed hops, but because she's Australian, as in kangaroo. And he feels there's some sort of simpatico between these people about his age, whereas he's 42 going on 102, and Diana's 29 and living like the young lady, bright, bubbly character that she is.
Okay, I want to know, where is Kanga today?
Well, I Kanga is actually hopefully in more heavenly pastures. She died many years ago, and of course that, yeah, absolutely. And looking back at that, the joys of youth, thank God for good moisturizer. there were certain things. There were certain things going on with Prince Charles. When I went down to Windsor, my main job at the time in the mid 70s, this was before any association was going on and marriages and whatever, was to see the latest girlfriend of the Prince of Wales, who he was with. And, you know, he was dating Diana's sister at one time, Sarah, who had anorexia. So Earl Spencer, right, her father, thought it would be a good idea to get her out in public with Prince Charles, and he was agreeable to doing that. And then, of course, Charles met Diana at Park House in Sandringham, which the Spencers rented, which was not too far from Sandringham Heights. And so, and also at one time, Earl Spencer, well before Philip came along, was considered as a possible husband material for the then Princess Elizabeth. So it's all rather tightly knit as to how it all came about.
You know, in that clip, you talk about that Charles was spending time with Camilla. And I think you were one of the first people that mentioned that Camilla was still in the picture. You know, looking now, 30 years later, was it an inevitability that that was going to be the way things worked out?
Well, I personally think it was an inevitability. I mean, Diana was not going to be a person willing to be swept under the royal red carpet, and made that abundantly clear on that infamous interview with Martin Bashir of the BBC, when she famously said that there were three people in the marriage. Was the one obviously too many? And that was just too much. And then, of course, the tragedy with her death in Paris in 1997. And then, of course, Charles marrying Camilla, again at St. George's Chapel, funnily enough, at Windsor. And they've been happily married. So I'm glad that it worked out for him. I mean, even errant princes of Wales deserve a second chance. And I said that on Joan's show a number of times as well. And I think it has worked out well for them. I think they're a very loving couple. I think Prince Charles is far more at ease, and he's happily married, and it's working out. And more importantly, that William and Harry have accepted her as the stepmother. She's no longer the wicked stepmother. and of course, in July, William and Harry are meant to be together. We'll see what happens there for the unveiling of a statue to their late mother at Kensington Gardens, which is right next to Kensington Palace in London, where they were brought up. But I wait and see if there'll be a reconciliation, because the wedding, not the funeral, should I say, on Saturday, apparently that Harry and William will not be walking down the aisle at St. George's Chapel together. Apparently the cousin, Peter Phillips, who is the son of Princess Anne, will be between them. So I wait and see what's going to happen here. I would like to see them reconciled, but it doesn't look very good at the moment. It doesn't bode well, I think.
You know what we'll now get to Harry and Meghan. What we've heard so far is that Harry has obviously seen Eugenie, who is at his house. So has he seen anybody else in the family since he's been back?
As far as I know, he's been lying low at Nottingham Cottage, is where he lived at Kensington Palace, when he started going out with Meghan Markle 2 years ago. And of course, St. George's Chapel, as you may well remember, was the venue for that wonderful wedding 2 years ago, which was quite extraordinary by any standards. You know, the gospel choir, all the people there. It couldn't have been a more perfect day. But we never knew what was going to happen. You can't look forward. And as you know, ironically, that Meghan and Harry just lived 1 minute's drive away from me here in Montecito, where I'm a columnist for the Montecito Journal. It is ironic, and we haven't seen very much of them, which can be put down to the pandemic. Obviously, they want to be safe and locked down. They live in great splendor in this $9 million house. It's got something like the 9 bedrooms, 16 bathrooms. I mean, talk about a royal flush. it's quite extraordinary because, you know, we live in a wonderful area. We have everybody here. We've got celebrities galore, Oprah, Ellen DeGeneres, Jeff Bridges, George Lucas, Kevin Costner. One can go on and on and on. And they moved here in July, and they live in an area called Riven Rock, which is rather lovely. It's all grand private estates, and they have their own security team, not provided by Buckingham Palace. And I was doing a German TV show the other day. They went up there to get some footage, and they were met by the security team team from Prince Harry's estate. And they were all young people in their 20s who were absolutely, they were absolutely charming. They weren't aggressive. They weren't confrontational. And they all they merely said was, this is a private road. You're not allowed to film. And the German TV crew had got what they wanted in any way and then relayed this back to me, their encounter with the security. And I think it's a very good thing. I mean, security around here, it's very unusual. I mean, no one I know, having covered celebrities all the years I've covered them, has security with them. So the idea that when Prince Harry goes down to the beach on his bicycle, he's then followed by four security guards in a black Range Rover to make sure no harm comes to him, which to me really, unfortunately, is more of an attraction for people, because if he just came down on his bicycle with his mask on and his helmet, no one would know who the hell he is, you know? So I think there's something we said about being low-key. But we live in days of pandemic, and I can understand why he wants to keep low-key, obviously for the sake of his son, Archie, who's about 16 months old now. And of course, Meghan's expecting a daughter in the summer, probably June or July. So that's why she hasn't gone to England, because of the situation with her pregnancy. So it's all on Harry, really. And
Is that really the reason she's not going, or is that just a lovely, convenient excuse?
Well, I think it's obviously legitimate, given she's only 2 or 3 months from delivering a baby. Well, on the other hand, also, maybe even if she wasn't pregnant, I don't think she'd have been, you know, very keen on going back to England, because a lot of people in England rather sadly view her as a pariah. And Harry was enormously popular at one time before his wedding to Meghan, much like the Duke of Windsor was back in the 30s when he was the son of King George V, and then decided to give up being the monarch to marry the woman he loved, Wallis Simpson, who was another divorced American. So here we have this basically rather a replay. So I wait to see how it plays out. You know, it's not like hokey pokey when you can have one leg in and one leg out. Either you're a royal doing royal service or you're not. And that is something that Harry has to make a decision on quite soon.
Yeah, I followed all of this very carefully. And, you know, it's interesting when we look back to Diana, the press was relentless against her. They were relentless against Sarah Ferguson. I think people forget that this is something that comes with the territory. I think because Kate has gotten a much easier road for some reason, she's the exception to the rule. I think princesses who marry into this family are really hounded by the press.
Well, I don't think it's easy becoming a member of the royal family, but in the case of Kate, who's Prince William's wife, the Duchess of Cambridge, I think she's handled it admirably with aplomb. They've got three glorious children. You've got George, who is the heir to the throne after William. And then you've got that little girl, Charlotte, who's really in the mirror image of the current queen. And then you've got the little boy, really, and you've got that little boy, Prince Louis. And, you know, they are going to be the royal family in the future. We're going to have, obviously, the queen, who celebrates her 95th birthday later this month. And her mother died at the age of 102 in 2002. So the genes are there. So the queen will probably reign for another 5 or 6 years. And then Charles will come on. And he said that he might like to be known rather than Charles III, because of the unfortunate background of some Charleses getting their heads chopped off, like Charles I. He might want to be known. He might want to be known George VII in honor of his grandfather, who was George VI. So we'll see what happens there. But so I obviously, very sadly, but life is life and death is death. So I think probably another 5 or 6 years, Queen Elizabeth would be joining Prince Philip in the vault at St. George's Chapel, where they will repose together for eternity. Much like her mother, the Queen Mother, and her father, King George VI, who have a special chapel at Windsor, where they're together, much like other monarchs who live there now.
Sure. I'm just curious, what do you think, what do you make of the criticisms that Meghan has made towards the press? Do you feel that they have been harder on her than, say, Fergie and Diana?
Well, I don't think they've been harder on certainly Meghan than they have been on Diana. Fergie, though, I feel sometimes deserves it, rather, given her behavior, her toe-sucking behavior, And Prince Philip couldn't stand her. And he said, I'll have nothing to do with that woman. She's brought down the royal family. And it's very interesting that Fergie will not be attending the funeral on Saturday. But I do think that Meghan at the moment, it's an interesting situation, a tale of two countries, because in America, there's a great deal of sympathy towards Meghan and Harry. But in Britain, they're very much hated, I think, actually, because I told some friends of mine who are great royalists that Harry and Meghan had moved next to me, and they wrote back, you're welcome to them. And then this whole business with my old friend, Piers Morgan, who I know for 20 years since he worked on the stuff. There's a lot of controversy. I think it's all very sad. I do hope the two brothers get together, hopefully now. But if they're going to have to march behind the coffin of Prince Philip, which is going to be this Land Rover Defender that he has specially altered in anticipation of his death, which is going to carry him. It's this green military Land Rover Defender. And that will take him to the chapel and then went to where he will be put into the royal vault until the Queen dies in 5 or 6 years' time, so they can actually lie together, much like ancestors like Queen Victoria and Prince Albert did many, many years ago, nearby at the Frogmore Mausoleum. So there's a great deal of ceremonial there, but it's so sad that because of this current virus situation, that this glorious occasion, although it is a funeral, is going to be so low-key and limited access to anybody but direct members of the royal family. I mean, this is a place that can sit 800 people, and we're talking about 30 people. And the Queen is going to be very sad. She's going to be sitting there with a mask on all by herself because she can't be next to anybody. And then the other members of the royal family are going to be dotted around for separation purposes. It's not what it should be. It's a very sad. The timing is never perfect for a death. But in this case, because of the pandemic, it makes it immeasurably worse, I think.
Did Prince Philip go home knowing that he was going home to die? Because those photos that we saw of him leaving the hospital, going home, he looked like he was just hanging on.
Well, I think he really did. And I think other members of the royal family did as well. As you probably might remember, when his son, Prince Charles, went to visit him and he was photographed leaving in the car and he had tears in his eyes. So I think he fully realized that this is one of the last times that he would ever see his father. And also for the other members of the royal family, Princess Anne, Prince Edward, and even Prince Andrew, who called him the grandfather of the nation, which I think is a good title for him. And I met Prince Philip many, many times, and he could be very abrasive, and he could be very rude, but I actually found him rather witty and funny. But he did not suffer fools gladly. If he didn't like you, he let you know it. He wasn't, we have to be polite because he's the ambassador to this or the future president of that. If he said what he thought.
For better or for worse.
Indeed, absolutely. And he made many gaffes in his life, which many people found amusing. Other people found totally undiplomatic. But he led a great life. As I say, he was married to the Queen for 73 years, and he did great service for the country. I think I read somewhere that during his lifetime, he did something like 22,000 engagements, which is quite extraordinary. And he retired from public service, as it were, 7 years back, and he'd been staying at Sandringham, the Queen's estate, in the southeast of England, in Norfolk, where he bothered himself reading and painting and doing other things. But he really wanted to die at Windsor because his mother, Princess Alice of Greece, who was the great granddaughter of Queen Victoria, was born at the castle. And he had great memories of the castle. And of course, now he's being buried there. So as he once said, jokingly, he said, just shove me in the car and take me to Windsor. And it's going to be like the same sort of thing. He's not going to be shoved into a car, but he'll be put very grandly with his ducal flag of his English oak casket, which is going to be lined with lead, as is the normal thing with members of the royal family, much like the popes in Rome, so they don't decay as quickly. And then he'll be, as it were, instead of being shoved, gently lowered into the royal vault at St. George's Chapel, where in 5 or 6 years' time, Queen Elizabeth will also repose.
You know, you mentioned Piers Morgan earlier, and I've been very conflicted about this whole situation because it seems that somehow, and I don't know how this has happened, that if you criticize Meghan or don't like her, somehow you are racist. And I haven't heard anything Piers has said that sounds racist. It sounds like he doesn't like her. And is it possible that it's just as simple as that?
Yeah, I think I agree with you entirely. I don't think there's any racism there whatsoever. I know that before Meghan got married to Harry, that Piers had met her a few times and they got on quite well. But as soon as this came out about her relationship with Harry, he was sort of dropped. And I think he feels some, you know, umbrage about that as well. And I think what he said is absolutely right. I mean, why, if you've been a good friend at one time, just because you're going out with the Queen's grandson, why should the relationship be ended? And he's been quite verbal about it. He had a perfect platform. He was a co-anchor on Good Morning Britain, which is a major TV morning show in the UK. And as you know, they had this tremendous row with the local weatherman on the show who took Piers to task. He criticized Meghan again. And Piers very publicly walked out of the set and said, that's it, I'm quitting. And then, of course, let's bring in the American side, because then we have Sharon Osbourne defending Piers. I know, and then that became another racist element because of the other participant on the show, and it's been such and such a mess. And I read something this morning that Sharon Osbourne is going to be talking about it on Bill Maher's show. About the repercussions to it. And I think there might also be a lawsuit with CBS, the producers of the show. So we wait and see what that stirs up, you know?
Yeah, I think that it's sort of a sign of the times we're living through, because somehow Sharon saying on television that she did not necessarily agree with everything Piers said, but she defended his right to speak it, especially being paid to be a commentator, somehow made Sharon a racist. And I don't know how the whole narrative has been upended.
Well, yeah, it's been extraordinarily controversial. I don't think Sharon Osbourne is at all racist. I don't think that Piers Morgan, who I said I've known for 20 years since he was on the London Sun doing the Bazaar column, I don't think Piers is racist. And I think that Piers will eventually come back bigger and stronger than ever. He said he has other. He sent me an email just the other day saying he has other things to do, and I'm sure there'll be no shortage of offers because he attracts numbers. He's a major writer for the London Daily Mail, my old employer, very popular. He's also very popular on TV, not just the morning show that he did for ITV in England, but I think he'll be back bigger and stronger than ever. And he has a great support base with the British public.
You know, again, we've talked about this racist issue, and it seems that this really picked up steam when Meghan did the interview with Oprah and basically put out there that people wondered about the skin color of the child. And it was very interesting. The day after that interview, Whoopi Goldberg on The View revealed something that, as a white person, I had never thought of. She said every mixed race couple has this discussion that people will wonder, I wonder what color the child will be, which isn't racist, it's a question. But do you think that just because of the times we're living in and Meghan kind of putting that out there, that that's what has made this become the major issue, is everybody is racist?
I think it was all very incendiary. I was on the Fox News channel talking about it actually. And I said it was very much like saying, you know, well, do you think we'll take after the dad? Do you think we'll take after the mum? Will it have blonde hair? Will it have brown hair? Will it have blue eyes? Will it have green eyes? Will it have a certain skin tone? You know.
Oh, we've lost your audio, Richard. Hold on. Hopefully, Richard, hold on 1 second because I'm not hearing you. Let me take you out and put you back in. Okay, try to. Oh, you're muted now. Unmute.
Hold on.
Okay, there you are. Perfect. Yep, you're back. Yep.
I didn't. The joys of technology. I can't change a plug without trepidation.
Richard, you've done so well with this. Thank you.
Well,
people don't know what we did backstage. Yes. Well, you know, I think the.
You better explain that.
I think. Well, you know, I think that, you know, going back to the racist issue, I think because you admit, first off, you know, I have to admit something. It never occurs to me when I look at Meghan Markle that she is a black woman. Maybe I don't see color, but unless somebody kept telling me, you know, I'm a black woman, I just see a woman. But because it was her and Oprah having this conversation, I think it heightened the awareness of, oh, everyone's against her because she's black.
Well, my abiding memory of all that really is at that wonderful time at the wedding 2 years ago when Prince Charles took her mother, Doria Ragland, by the arm, because obviously the father, Thomas Markle, couldn't turn up because he had a heart condition, so he was unable to attend. But I thought that loving moment that Prince Charles escorted Doria Ragland down the aisle of St. George's Chapel for the signing of the register. And I thought that was an extraordinary moment. I thought it was very loving, very encompassing. I don't think there was any racism there whatsoever. And this has really been, in my opinion, has been blown out, unfortunately, out of all proportion, really.
Do you think, you know, there's been a lot of speculation that the royal family is racist. Do you believe that there is racist elements in the royal family?
Absolutely not. In fact, I think William put it very clearly when he was asked by a member of the press at some event a couple of weeks back when he said, is the royal family racist? And William said, absolutely not. And I think that's absolutely true. Because when you think of one of the dearest organizations close to the Queen's heart is the Commonwealth, which dates back, right, you know, many, many decades, even centuries. And most of the people in these countries that are the Commonwealth are black and Asian. And the Queen regularly has meetings at Buckingham Palace or Windsor Castle with these people and the ambassadors. So there's clearly no racism, in my opinion, there whatsoever. It's all encompassing, you know, and that's the kind of thing we should have these days, you know. I think racism, hopefully, is something of the past. I know it's certainly there, but not within the royal family, in my opinion.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time in England, and certainly it seems to me, and again, maybe I'm blind to it, but it seems to me that England is a far less racist country than the United States.
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, obviously, I haven't been in England since 1977 when I moved to New York to join Rupert Murdoch's Star as gossip columnist. But I go back there occasionally, and I see no major signs of racism whatsoever. I think people have integrated very, very well. And this particular situation with the Oprah interview has been very incendiary. And it must be quite hurtful at this stage in the game for the Queen, and also having to deal with Prince Philip, and then this problem with her grandsons, William and Harry, and then these claims on Oprah's show. I mean, at 95, do you really need this on your shoulders, quite frankly?
What do you think about Harry making the decision to sit down with Oprah?
Well, I think personally, it was a big mistake. The only one who actually benefited from this sit down was Oprah. She supposedly got paid $7 to $9 million, according to the Wall Street Journal, by CBS for this sit down. And that in turn was then sold on. I know that ITV in London paid something like $1.5 million for the broadcast rights there. And of course, it garnered a huge audience, as did the broadcast in America. I personally think it wasn't a good decision on particularly Harry's part. And he just seemed to sit there and in a subservient way, while Meghan really took charge. And I think that really the power behind the throne. in many
yeah,
ways.
Yeah, it seemed to me that he is, that she is the one calling the shots in that marriage. And that could just be his demeanor. And maybe he is a strong person, but it certainly didn't show there. It almost felt like Harry was an afterthought.
Well, I think so. And now you've got this decision because he's lost all these honorary ranks that he had, particularly Captain General of the Royal Marines in England, which, of course, the Duke of Edinburgh had held for something like 60 years. And this has been a major thorn right now for this funeral on Saturday. What uniforms would they wear? And, of course, everybody was supposed to be wearing some sort of uniform, but Harry, because he had lost all these ranks. So now it's been decided that the people of the royal family will not be wearing uniforms, but just black tailcoats or ordinary dresses and hats and whatever. So that's been avoiding that. And of course, Prince Andrew, arrogant fellow that he often is, purportedly demanded to wear an admiral's uniform, although he's not an admiral. So the Queen obviously has done what she thinks is right and just said, look, forget the uniform situation. Let's just go tailcoats, black tailcoats for the men, and then black hats and black dresses for the women, which hopefully has resolved the situation. But we'll see what happens on Saturday.
Do you think that there is a route where Harry can still be a member of the family while being married to Meghan and living in California?
I personally don't see it. I think that if he's over here, then he's over here. As I said, you can't have one leg in and one leg out. And I think he's lost an awful lot. I mean, I think that rank of Captain General in the Royal Marines of Britain was very dear to him. And he supposedly wanted to wear a Blues and Royals outfit that he wore at his wedding for the funeral. And of course, as he doesn't have that rank any longer, he was told no. So I think it's hurt him in many, many ways. And of course, back in November, when wreaths were laid at the cenotaph in London, which obviously is a tribute to the war dead of both World War I and World War II, and he would normally be there with the Queen laying a wreath. But he wanted to do the same this year, but of course, or last year, shall I say. But he was told, no, I can't do that. And they did this rather feeble thing down at the Veterans Cemetery down in Los Angeles, there near San Vicente Boulevard. And he laid a wreath, which I suppose was a token, but nothing like he would normally have done with the whole royal family, including the Queen there, to lay these wreaths with Prince Charles and whatever at the cenotaph, all in their uniforms and their, you know, medals and whatever honors they have, you see.
You know, and I think it bears mentioning, as you mentioned earlier, that the Duke and Duchess of Windsor went through this when the Duke's mother died and he came back and Wallace stayed behind. You know, we see these patterns I think they perpetuate.
Well, another time they actually did get together. They came back for an unveiling of a plaque to his mother, Queen Mary, the wife of George V. At Marlborough House, which was her royal residence. It's just down the road from Clarence House and St. James's Palace. And he was with Wallace at the event. But Wallace got a very cool reception from the Queen Mother, as has been shown in a number of films and documentaries, because the Queen Mother always blamed Wallace for the early death of George VI. Because as we all know, he had that famous stammer, which was shown in the King's Speech, that great movie. And also he had one lung removed because he smoked like a chimney. And she thought that obviously all the overwhelming pressure that he got when he became king, having just been Duke of York, not supposed in waiting, because obviously Edward VIII was meant to be Edward VIII until he fell off the throne and died. But that was not to be the case. So the Queen Mother never forgot that. And that's why, for instance, you know, Wallace Simpson never got the honor of being called Her Royal Highness, because the Queen Mother said, no, we're not calling her Royal Highness, and she was never allowed to do that. Although the Duke very often embarrassed the British ambassador to France when he referred to Her Royal Highness when they're having events at their house in the Bois de Boulogne. But of course, the ambassador just kept his mouth shut and didn't say a word.
I think that there is a lot of history repeating itself now. Richard, our time has flown by, but please, can we count on you to be our royal correspondent for all things in the future?
Anytime, Billy. It's so nice to see you all to say very long, and thank you for sorting out that little technical problem we had earlier. Well done. You're hired.
Thank you so much for doing it. Thank you. And anytime you need me, just call. I'm here for you.
Anytime, Billy. Thank you very much, and have a good week.
Thank you, Richard. We'll see you again. Bye-bye. Oh, my God. From there to local gossip, we have former West Hollywood mayor John Duran is here. Hi, John.
Billy, I learned so much about the royal family and everything else. I've been tuning in and listening. It was fascinating.
It's like watching The Crown, only less highbrow.
Yeah, I think we're going to skip over Charles and go straight to William. That's my guess.
Yeah, I think that you never know. That could happen. John, first off, you look fabulous. Have you lost weight? What happened? You look like you're 10 years younger.
I'm buff and I'm, yeah. Buff.
You look really good.
Thank you, babe. That's awesome.
I haven't seen you since January. I guess our New Year's Eve show. I saw you that week before. Yeah. So how are things going in West Hollywood?
They're going good. Actually, I'm getting my second Moderna shot today. I know you're getting your second shot. We're both going to be fully immune. Yep. You know, LA is one of the hot spots in the world, has been in terms of the number of infections and 23,000 dead, over a million people infected in Los Angeles. But right now, the positivity rate is down to 1.3%, few hundred cases daily. I mean, we're doing, for a county of 10 million people, we're doing great. And West Hollywood specifically, there was a great deal of concern about the threat with all the gay bars closed, when we'd lose a lot of gay businesses. And the reality, we did. We lost a handful.
We did.
Oil Can Harry's and we lost the Gold Coast.
Gold Coast and Rage, although it's coming back kind of.
That's what's happening. And, you know, I talked to Monty Overstreet, who's the property owner. And elderly
Blazing Saddles as well.
Yes, he owns
Gym Bar.
All these buildings. And I talked to he and his husband, John, I guess it was over the summer, and it said, you know, it's really important for the ongoing legacy of West Hollywood being a gay sanctuary in Mecca, that if these gay bars close down, that they reopen as gay. And you know what? To their credit, they were already on it. And we're seeing that. We're seeing rebirth and renaissance and new gay bars opening where old gay bars closed.
Yeah.
You know what? We're, as a people, we're very resilient. You know, we went through an epidemic once before, and the gay bars and businesses survived. Our gay bars and businesses are going to survive as well.
Well, I think that, you know, I've noticed during the pandemic that trends that were already in place had accelerated a little bit. Bars had become difficult to maintain. Yeah. And so this was like a shakeout period. The people who could survive did, but others, maybe it came a little quicker than they expected. But what do you think about West Hollywood reopening and people being able to dine and shop and congregate?
You know, they're out. I had dinner last night at Hugo's indoors.
My favorite place.
The restaurants are reopening. People are out and about again. People are coming out of their caves. You know, at this point, half of LA County has been vaccinated with at least one shot. So we're rebounding. We're reopening. And it's great to see. It's great to see. I mean, I feel
How safe do you feel?
I feel very safe.
Do you really?
I feel very safe. I mean, I have been pretty good, not completely compliant, but, you know, 90%, mostly staying at home and staying apart and doing what I can. And you know, I've known people who contracted COVID. I've actually known a handful of people who died because of COVID. But, you know, I feel very safe. And, you know, my doctor, Michael Gottlieb, is one of the co-discoverers of HIV. He has a theory about HIV positive people on meds having a lot of natural interferon produced by their bodies, which acts as a shield or a buffer to COVID. It makes sense, right? We're pumping all these antivirals in our bodies today for years, and it's given us an extra layer of protection from our own natural interferon against COVID-19. Mm-hmm. People with HIV, for the most part, you know, if we get it, we're not getting severely sick or dying.
Isn't that interesting?
I think it's interesting too. And I thought it must be the drugs we take, but no, my doctor said, no, it's not the drugs. It's that we produce so much natural interferon because we've been on drugs for years and years and years to fight off viruses. I thought that was fascinating.
I also wonder if maybe people who are not even just people who are HIV positive, but gay people who take a virus seriously, maybe they've been more careful or following the guidelines because they know up, you know, like before AIDS, people weren't wearing condoms. Now they're all wearing condoms. They adapted.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, you and I both know barebacking's back.
So yeah, I know.
Since we got PrEP on the playing field, all of a sudden that's all back. Look, the point is, I think you're making a really good point, and that is that the gay community, we've been through something like this. We had to learn how to adapt and how to change in order to make room for the presence of the virus. And the reality is, HIV's not gone away. COVID is not going away. It's going to be here for years, and we're just going to have to adapt our behaviors and change our customs in order to live with the virus. Another one.
How available are vaccines in West Hollywood?
They're pretty available. I mean, people are able to get them starting today. In fact, in Los Angeles, anybody 16 years or older is now eligible for a vaccine. So here in California, you know, everybody's eligible, and people are stepping up, and, you know, I have family members who are Trumpers, pains me to say, but even they're starting to change and see, like, okay, it's not a hoax. It is real, and we need to do stuff to protect ourselves. So I have hope.
You know, you and I have talked before about sex during COVID. You know, we've had sex in the time of AIDS.
Right,
now
right.
We have sex in the time of COVID.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, some people were being careful. Some people were being reckless. I mean, that's always the case. What's happening now in terms of gay sex?
You know, I think that is things are going back to normal, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Meaning that while the pandemic was raging, COVID was raging, I know it was pretty common for guys to mask up, you know? You would even see on Grindr and stuff, people in masks, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're sending a message. I'm going to come to your place. We're going to hook up, but I'm going to still take precautions. I'm going to mask up, and you should too. And, you know, the whole idea that it's the breath, the droplets coming out of the nose
right.
that are dangerous, you know, means that certain things that were safe with HIV, like kissing, are not safe when it comes to COVID. So, but now, you know, at least here in LA, West Hollywood, with only 1.3% of the tests turning up positive, you know, 400 cases a day out of a county of 10 million, we're pretty good. And the thing about West Hollywood, our demographics, it's mostly people living alone or two people,
right.
or two people living per household, right? So we're able to stay apart as opposed to other parts of LA County where you may have extended family members and 6 to 8 people living in one household. We've got one or two. So we've been pretty successful.
You know, what's happening with real estate in West Hollywood? Because I know that at a certain point in the pandemic, people were leaving to go to either less populous areas and that suddenly there was a lot of vacancies available. Is real estate rebounding?
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's still a high demand for housing
really?
In LA, all of Los Angeles, especially West Hollywood. People in the rent controlled units like you and me, you know, we're able to maintain our rent controlled units for as long as we need to. But, you know, the market rates on the vacancies are very high. So that tells
really?
Me the high supply is still low and it's going to continue for a while. Yeah, we just can't build enough housing in West Hollywood.
Maybe it's already happened. When do you see like nightclubs reopening or nightclub or people actually congregating to have cocktails or dance or socialize?
Right. So nightclubs with kitchens like the
right.
Abbey and Rocco's are already open and have been open for weeks. Hamburger Mary's. They're all mm-hmm. open. They're bars, but they have a kitchen. So it's considered food establishment. And
right.
they've been able to maintain their patios. We're now getting ready to go to the next level in LA, which is that bars, like the ones that have been closed all this time, Mickey's, Revolver, Trunks, can open their patios again. And that's
going
to be coming next week. So we're getting there. The Hollywood Bowl has announced that they're going to be open in July. I'm so happy. I missed the
really?
Hollywood
Bowl. Really? Great.
The Hollywood Bowl is opening in July. Knott's Berry Farm later this month. Disneyland.
What percentages? I mean, it can't be full percentage.
No,
be
the Hollywood 30, Bowl limit their apparently their attendance to 7,000 only, and I think they seat 14,000.
Yeah, so it's 50-ish.
Yeah, 50%. And the first few nights are going to be free for healthcare workers. They're putting on.
Oh, isn't that great?
To thank all the healthcare workers that got us through the pandemic, which I think is awesome. Yeah.
Well, I mean, last summer, I remember the numbers did dip. So I would assume that because we're on this trajectory already and summer is coming, we should be in good shape. I worry about what will happen in the aftermath of that, if the fall could be another issue, and if it's going to turn into a situation where we're going to need to get another vaccine.
I think it's possible we may need boosters. But at this rate of vaccination, at least here in LA and maybe in other big cities around the country, with all the vaccinations going on, you know, we are slowly growing herd immunity between those who got infected and survived and those who are now vaccinated. The herd immunity continues to expand. And yeah, we have to be wary for mutants and variants, and we have to be prepared to take boosters like we would at the flu shot, right? You get a flu shot every year in order to ward off whatever the recent strain of flu is. We're probably going to see something similar with COVID. But I,
you know, go ahead. You know, I've been reading about the variant that has been in Los Angeles, or is there two? I've lost track of the variants.
Yeah, there's the British variant. It's mostly on the East Coast. And then we have the California variant.
Yeah.
Is the cooler of the two. Cooler meaning it's not as contagious, it's not as deadly. It's kind of this, you know, chill virus. It's a chill virus, and it's not going to kill you, not going to take you out. So, and it is the predominant virus in California right now, much more so than the UK virus, which thankfully is helping slow the spread here in California.
Are they saying that the vaccines that we have now, the Moderna and the Pfizer, how effective are they with this variant in California?
Completely effective. They have determined that the current vaccinations are able to pull back the variants and mutants that we know about. Now, is this forever? Who knows? But, you know, I feel like we're on top of it. And oh my God, I think where we were a year ago, we had, you know, the President of the United States telling us to put UV ray cathodes in our mouths and up our arse, right?
And drink Clorox.
Drink bleach. And I mean, it was insane. And it was all going to go away by Easter. And all this is under control. And it's like so many lies upon lies upon lies. It cost us hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, someday the history books will reflect all this. But now I feel like we're on top of it. Even the fact that they've scaled back the Johnson & Johnson vaccine because women died tells me that, you know, their priority is safety. Safety is their priority, which is really good news.
How do you feel the President Biden is doing? Because, I mean we've had a huge change in everything.
Yeah, I'm a Biden fan. You know, during the primary, I was with Kamala. Kamala Harris was my candidate because I know her personally here in California. But, you know, Biden, I think, one, he's not tweeting. Two, he's not golfing, right? Three, he's actually dealing with Russia and dealing with Iran and dealing with North Korea.
And Afghanistan.
And Afghanistan, all these international threats. He's moving on climate change. You know, like he's doing like what a real president is supposed to do. And he's not tweeting and golfing and calling out grievances, you know? Meanwhile, the former guy continues to do what he's always done, just without a Twitter account, which I'm so happy. I'm so happy.
Well, it's, you know what, it didn't even occur to me until, I guess, maybe beginning of March. I went, my God, I don't wake up in the morning and think, oh no, what has he done now? Like, there are days that go by I don't even think about the president.
Right.
Which those are good days.
That is, and for all previous presidents prior to Trump, I never worried about what they were going to do today, day to day. Might have agreed or disagreed, but I didn't feel like, you know, the existence of the world was under threat daily. It's such a relief, right? It's such a relief. Hopefully we get back to gay pride next year. I mean, here locally.
Yeah, apparently we're not going to have one this year.
No, not going to have one. And hopefully, Billy, you and I get back on the main stage.
Oh, my God.
Right?
Yeah, what is going to happen now? There's been this whole drama with Christopher Street West and defunct, and now we're going to find a new group, or maybe it's going to be controlled in-house. John, we should run it.
We should just create something, Billy. Don't tell anybody except your
viewers. Do you remember that friend of yours? Was he in Venice that wanted us to start something 2 years ago?
Yeah. We still might. You know, God knows what's going to happen. You know, Christopher Street West wants to go downtown. God bless him. There's already something.
Good luck.
You know, we don't need downtown. We got Santa Monica Boulevard between La Cienega and Robertson. You know, it's gay pride every day of the year. So
I know. And by the way, I will say happy birthday, Mama. It was Worthy's birthday yesterday.
Yes, I wished her a happy birthday yesterday. I miss Mama. Yeah.
Well, again, my co-host, I can't do anything without her. So lastly, since we're talking about L.A., let's talk about Gavin Newsom and what's going to happen with him.
I think he's going to be okay. You know, he's got the recall.
Really?
Yeah, the way recalls work in California, it's a two-part question on the ballot. One, do you wish to recall the governor? Yes or no. And then two, if he's recalled, who do you want to have replace him? And all the replacements are horrible Republicans that really don't fit with California. So,
and Caitlyn Jenner.
Yeah, and if you're going to vote to recall Gavin Newsom, who, by the way, is a personal hero of mine, who are you going to replace him with? You know, some right writer from San Diego, is that where you want to preside over the state of California? I don't. So I think California now is so solidly blue, so much like Massachusetts. So, although you guys
really, because
are Republicans sometimes.
Yeah, we do. And the other thing is, I think people forget that California does have a strong Republican voice, not in Los Angeles, obviously, but elsewhere. If you go south, if you go north, there's a lot of support.
They do in inland California, but interestingly, there are now more registered independents in California than registered Republicans.
Really?
It's Democrats first, then independents, and then Republicans. And the independents tend to lean with the Democrats. Actually, I've fantasized for years now about re-registering independent, but I would tend to lean with the Democrats too. Yeah.
Yeah, I for years, and I may still be registered as an independent. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'd have to look. Okay, before I let you go, okay, predictions. What's going to happen over the next, say, 2 months in West Hollywood? What will there be any major change, or will we just get back to status quo?
I think we're going to almost get back to status quo, but there'll be some permanent changes. You know, whenever there's plague or war or famine, things in any culture and society change permanently. That's been true throughout all human history. You know, AIDS and HIV change so much from how we go.
We're still wearing condoms. Yeah, even if we are on PrEP, we wear condoms.
And I think that COVID, you know, is going to leave a residue behind. More meetings on Zoom, you know, less face-to-face interaction, more social distancing.
Are masks here to stay?
For a while. I think for a while until it's completely under control. You know,
certainly for travel.
Yeah, for travel, you know, carriers, buses, trains, planes. I think that just makes sense. You know, countries in Europe, because the U.S. was so severely impacted, they're going to want to see that you were doubly vaccinated. You know, Hawaii's now doing you need to show proof of vaccine to come to the island, because they've been doing such a good job of keeping it under control. They don't want it coming over from the mainland. So those are the sort of changes I think we're going to see.
And these are long term.
We'll adapt. And, you know, people are like, I'm an American. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that. It's like, come on, just get with the program. Adapt, be flexible. We're all going through this. All 7 billion of us on the planet are having to deal with this right now. So can we just get along for a little bit? Hopefully so.
Oh, John, I love you. I'm so glad we got to catch up. It's been too long. And you're always my mayor.
Oh, Billy, I love you too. And I will come anytime you want to gossip politics, WeHo, LA, anything like that. You call on me.
You are my expert. Thank you, John. I will see you soon. And I can't wait to get back next month. Now that once we're all safe next month, I'll see you next month.
I will see you on Santa Monica Boulevard, Billy.
Take care, sweetheart. Bye, John.
Bye-bye.
Thank you all for watching Billy Masters Live. God, another show. So here's what happened, just so you guys know. Okay, so I'm about to start, and I get a phone call, and I don't pick up because, you know, I got a show to do. And then I look, and I'm like, I don't know that number, but the person left a message. So it was Richard Meinards, who couldn't text me, and he said to me, because like Justin Bieber, I don't have a cell phone. Okay. Two things about that. Number one, I don't believe Justin Bieber doesn't have a cell phone. And number two, I don't believe Richard Meinards has anything in common with Justin Bieber. And actually, I think I like Richard Meinards more. Anyway, so I had to call him up. He's on a Mac. I am not on a Mac. I am not of the Mac persuasion. Anything with an I, no, I'm not interested. But talked him through it. and another fabulous show. So anyway, thank you for watching Billy Masters Live. I've got to go get a vaccine. I don't know who we have next week. I don't, you know, it was a little frantic starting, so I don't know exactly who's coming up. I know that we've got Norm Corpy and Eric Nice are going to be on from the real world talking about the homecoming. What a drama there. I don't think I trusted that either. Anyway, we're going to talk about that. And then we're going to be having Michael Riedel, former columnist for the New York Post and the Daily News. He has a new book out on Broadway. And Eddie Shapiro, who has a book about the leading men of Broadway. So they will be here. There's so many people coming up. We've got Patti LaBelle coming. We've got Gladys Knight coming. There's so many people coming up. So just tune in to Billy Masters Live. And just remember, if we're here, we're live. I gotta go get a shot. Talk to you later. Bye, guys.